Hello and welcome to episode 27 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, a bored man has got access to a microphone and will use it to be wrong on the internet. I am that bored man and my name is Graham Lee. Actually, in this episode, I wanted to talk about the more general idea of being wrong on the internet and how programmers tend to underestimate the contextual knowledge required to make opinions about other people's projects, or rather to have valid opinions on other people's projects. I'm going to base this episode around a thread on the Lobsters programming forum. Lobsters is kind of hacker news for people who think they're better than being members of Hacker News. So it's got a very gatekeepery approach. You can only join if you're a member, if you're invited by an existing member. They have very strong ideas about what is and isn't on topic, and particularly things that are popular among the community of users will quickly get described as off topic by the sort of senior guard of the community because of some idea that, you know, something that is newsworthy or populist cannot itself be worthy of discussion within the community. So, you know, obviously there are things going into community formation on the internet, and particularly programming communities there. And I think the idea of forming small communities is, is a valuable one. The problem that you have with like a free-for-all community like Twitter is it's very easy for someone to make a statement thinking that they are talking to a group of people who understand their context and who understand, you know, who they are and why they are making that statement, only to then get piled on by people who perceive that statement in a different context and who think of it as offensive because perhaps it is a sarcastic statement that is not seen by people who understand that the person is a sarcastic person, or who have a different cultural background and don't interpret the statement through the lens of the first person's culture. Anyway, that is all a long and rambling aside. This thread on Lobsters, and I was mentioning the community formation to say that, you know, what Lobsters are trying to do is to grow a community through friend-of-friend recommendations. But what they have demonstrated is that it is very quick. You know, you only have to get a couple of degrees of separation from somebody before you no longer have the similar context and no longer understand community norms in the same way as the entire rest of the community. And that any form of policing that through what basically comes down to a sort of Slashdot style karma system is open to gaming, is, you know, not a particularly strong incentive, and it fundamentally doesn't work. You can't maintain a community culture by policing the community. You have to do it by growing a community that fosters that shared culture. And, you know, I think Lobsters was an attempt to do that, and other better attempts will come along later. This thread is sort of the Rust Evangelism strike force applied to climate modelling. There is an article, and the article is called Organisations Like the Met Office by Private Companies Here, not just the private companies you might think of, like shipping companies or petrochemical companies, but Formula One teams have their own like weather forecasting, short-term climate models to try and decide what tyre strategy to use during a race weekend. And they're used by various organisations. And, you know, policy decisions, planning decisions, routing, logistics, all these things use climate models. And the models are typically written in Fortran. And Fortran is a programming language from 1950. So, you know, there's your question. And the answer that is presented in the article is basically, like, because It comes down to, because they already were written in Fortran, and the models have been tuned to later hardware. I should point out at the moment that climate models run in this kind of niche of computing called high-performance computing, which is basically what used to be the sort of supercomputer market, and now is large data centers full of Linux PCs, but running the same software, like sort of middleware and applications, as the supercomputers have been doing for decades. So I will talk more about that particular ecosystem and that particular sort of programming context. But suffice it to say for the moment that if you already have a successful model in Fortran, you can tune that successful model in Fortran for newer hardware, newer operating systems, newer libraries, and even newer sort of programming paradigms. You can move from CPUs to GPUs much more easily than you can writing a new program from scratch in a new language. But the thread on lobsters contains a lot of why is this not done? Why don't they see the benefits of using a new programming language? One commenter even says it would only be the work of a few people and the cost of a few international flights and a conference to get this code rewritten in a modern language. And that is not true. There is decades of development that has gone into this thing, into any of these climate models. And that doesn't just mean decades of sunk cost, which, of course, is a fallacious reason to choose not to rewrite, but also decades of development, decades of bug fixing, decades of optimization. If you wanted to take another, a different programming language and write the model again, you could write a translator of the Fortran code into this other language, and maybe that would succeed, but maybe it wouldn't be the fastest execution of that program that is possible in the target language. It might not even be faster than the Fortran model, and of course you lose any benefits that you would get from translating to the switching to the new language, because you haven't actually switched to the new language. You're using Fortran ideas and Fortran idioms that just happen to be expressed in this other syntax. And I think what is happening here is people are going, oh, there's only so many million lines of code in a climate model, and it takes so long to write so many million lines of code. And anyway, why is it even that big? Surely it is just blah, blah, blah. And so I only need to write 10,000 lines of code because Haskell is awesome, and therefore it wouldn't take me very long to write 10,000 lines of Haskell. It can't take very long to get this right. But it's not only the simulation you have to get correct. The simulation is an expression of a model. We're talking about climate models, and the maths behind these models has been verified and published in the literature and critiqued, and then implemented in software, and the results of the software, of the software implementation of the model, have been tested and critiqued. Typically not at the small scale, and that's another issue here. High performance computing doesn't have a good relationship with software engineering concepts like unit testing or continuous integration or continuous deployment pipelines. Indeed, it has a questionable relationship with ideas like version control systems. But the version control systems are sort of becoming standard now, and not testing and CI. The idea of testing a climate model is put in what you know of the state of the climate from 1900 to 1950, and then run it with the initial conditions from 1900 and see whether 1950 comes out accurately. And then run it forwards from there and see whether 1975 comes out accurately, and then run it forwards from there and see if 1975 to 2000 comes out reflecting what really happened, or more likely reflecting a statistical probability of things that could happen that includes what actually happened over those decades. These tests can take days, if not weeks, to run. They can require a lot of computing equipment in a specific sort of custom configuration. These codes weren't designed with unit testing in mind, and that means that you can't just take the Fortran unit tests and see if your Julia code runs and gives the same results for each of those tests. Like I said before, nor would you want to if what you're trying to do is to somehow take advantage of the unique features of Julia, which you're arguing are a more modern and modern equals better, apparently, way of doing computing. You wouldn't want to take your design, which is encapsulated in your Fortran unit tests, and express that legacy design in Julia. That wouldn't be a true modernization. But it's not just that model and that expression of that model and the decades of use and correction and critique that have gone into it. It is the entire computing platform that supports those things that is fairly unique. So the way that parallelization works in high-performance computing, and I should disclose at this point that my experience of this is based mostly on having worked on one of the debugging tools that I'm going to mention, one of the debugging suites, rather, that I am going to mention in this episode. It is not the case that I'm working on these kinds of projects in my current university job. I'm doing mobile apps and node backends at the moment, as it happens. But these kinds of projects come up fairly frequently in one of the teams that I am on, which is the Oxford eResearch Centre. And that means that I still kind of hear about modern state of the art in high performance computing. If you want to look at what the sort of news and development in that field is, there are two big conferences a year, but there is also a sort of news website called Next Platform, which I'll link to in the show notes, and that is where you can see what people are interested in, and that in itself is quite a sort of surprising collection of topics. But the way that parallelization works in these sort of supercomputer or high performance computing models is that you have a large cluster of identical computers, and when I say large, you can use as few as two. You typically have one. Let's ignore the small case and look at the large case. So you would have what's called head nodes or login nodes, and those are the things that people are allowed to connect to with SSH and to SFTP or SCP their source code onto, and maybe they're allowed to run the compiler on those nodes to build their software, or maybe there are dedicated compile nodes, and there's just a front end that when you type make actually forwards the job to a compile node to build the software. Then there are batch nodes which run a batch submission program, which looks a lot like a sort of job control program from an old mainframe, and this will be software. An example is an open source one called Slurm, which is simple Linux utility for resource management. But Sun have provided sort of proprietary grid middleware in the past. There are alternatives. Slurm is just one that you can understand. Think of it like a sort of orchestration program, but it has a fixed idea of what the topology of the computer is, i.e. so what the other nodes in the cluster are, and is tracking which ones are in use, how big you say your job is, and how long you say your job is going to run for, and is using that information to sort of keep a live priority queue and push your job in when the required number of nodes are going to be available for the required amount of time. So the nodes that your thing actually runs on are called the compute nodes, and these would probably have a very, very simple read-only Linux operating system mounted, which would be something like BusyBox Linux. It would be something similar to what you'd use in a set-top box or a router. And then they would have a shared file system which has the software in the form of modules, which are basically sort of packages that are self-contained that have their own like lib folder and their own bin folder, and a script that tells the operating system how to set up the path and the LD library path and everything, so that that version of the library can be found. And then a file system that contains your executables, would probably just like your home folder, and somewhere to get the input data and store the output data. So you would typically say something like, run my program using a command called mpi run. This is the name of my executable on this many computers. And you know, that might be like 10 nodes, it might be 2 nodes for a test, it might be a couple of thousand nodes on a large installation. And then here's all the parameters for my simulation. And you would wrap that in a batch submission script that says, please run this batch thing over this many nodes, and I want 7 days of runtime. And the shorter the time that you ask for, the quicker you get allocated on the queue. But the risk is that if your program actually takes longer to run than the allocated time, it will just get killed and you don't get any results. And so what happens is that basically the batch nodes, to a very close approximation, SSH into 2,000 compute nodes and all run the same command with the same parameters, except for what is called the MPI rank, which is basically the number, the index of this computer in your execution cluster. So the first one will get rank 1 because Fortran is one index, and another one gets rank 2, and so on up to rank 2000. The rank 1 computer will be responsible for initializing a sort of check-in process where all of the other instances, it waits until it gets 1999 connections from other computers. And then when it has all of those, they all start going, and they communicate sending primitives over this thing called MPI, which is a message passing interface. And that can be barriers and semaphores, or it can be like sending integers. So you might your climate model might be a collection of connected cells that is 2,000 across latitude, 2,000 across longitude, and 20 across altitude. And so it might decide to split the thing into rectangles, which are 2,000 by 20, and give node 1 the x equals 1, y equals 1 to 2,000, z equals 1 to 20, and then give node 2 x equals 2, y equals 1 to 2,000, and z equals 1 to 20, and so on. So like each one will get told, execute the cells that are in x equals your rank, y equals the range, and z equals the range. And when they need to share information, because like the temperature or the wind velocity at a particular cell is going to influence the conditions at connecting cells, they would use this MPI interface to say, you know, I'm sending you a collection of doubles, and from rank 3 to rank 4, and then the rank 4 computer, when it receives that, is expected to know how to interpret that collection of doubles. So there's no sort of contextual or semantic message passing. It's not like object-oriented programming where you're doing remote method invocation. It is like sending very, you know, very sort of low-level primitive data. And that will happen typically over incredibly fast interconnects. So rather than like Ethernet networking all these things together, even with like gigabit or 10 gigabit internet, they might use InfiniBand, they might use other sort of fiber channel connections, and there will be some sort of topology that was individually architected for each installation, or a collection of sort of off the shelf, you know, so someone like Cray may sell a sort of, you know, a shipping container, or like just a room sized data center that has a standard like setup in it. So that's what's going on in between the computers. Now, on any individual computer, there could be a bunch of things happening. One is that the CPU or CPUs on the in the computer, and it's likely to be multiple, have multiple cores, and maybe even with technologies like hyperthreading can execute multiple parallel threads per core. And so you would use what's called OpenMP, which is a sort of open standard for multiprocessing, to make the computational work that is going on within a node parallelized. And that could be anything from, it would typically be something like, you would take a for loop in C or Fortran, and you would have a preprocessor, Pragma, that appears before the for loop that says this can be run in parallel over the variable I, which basically means that the iteration at I equals 10 doesn't depend on the results of the iteration at I equals 9. And so when the program is compiled, the compiler can look at the number of CPUs that are expected on the target computer and the number of iterations in the loop, and as well as unrolling the loop, can parallelize the loop. And then there'll be some information about where the sort of shared memory is, and whether it is accessed as a contiguous array that each element is independently accessed by a single thread, so that it doesn't need to worry about barriers or anything, or whether there is like a sort of a folded or a collected result, or some shared resource like a file handle that needs to be synchronized across the various cores. So that's one thing that can happen. And another thing that can happen is that you can put work onto the GPU. Now, the GPU basically does all of that stuff that I described OpenMP doing, but sort of internally. So obviously GPUs are graphics processing units. They were originally designed for 3D graphics, and using what are called shaders, which do particular sort of transformations on vectors of pixel data. And early on, some people realized that they could, if they squinted correctly, make their HPC model look a bit like a shading problem, and so started writing their implementations in the shading language. And the shading language is designed to say, right, apply this algorithm in parallel to this collection of data as fast as possible. So the idea behind the sort of hardware architecture is single instruction, multiple data, and the design of the hardware is that you'll have a collection of compute units that can all execute in parallel as long as they are all executing the same instruction in lockstep, although applying it to different data. So you might have 64 threads in what's called a warp in NVIDIA parlance that are all targeting the same fused add and multiply on a vector of 128-bit length, but on consecutive vectors in an array. So you need a bunch of compiler support for all of that to work. You need you need your MPI libraries. You probably need some sort of higher level mass libraries like basic linear algebra subroutines or fast Fourier transforms, or like domain specific mathematical libraries, and those need to be optimized for the target hardware and for use from the target language. You need compilers that are not only going to emit code that is optimized for turning the programming language into high performance execution on the target architecture, but are able to do these tricks like OpenMP and like sort of automatically threading in parallel based on requests from the programmer, or are able to target the, as I say, typically NVIDIA graphics cards and the GPU language, which these days is actually a general purpose language called CUDA. And you need tools that help you debug and measure and optimize the performance of all of that. And as far as I know, there are only two of those in wide use. Vendors like Intel and NVIDIA have, and ARM for that matter, have tools that are optimized for seeing what is going on their own hardware. But for a sort of end-to-end or integrated development experience with debugging and with performance analysis, there's basically there's a thing called TotalView, and there's the thing I worked on, which is called ArmForge. And the debugging perspective is basically answering the question, what is an efficient way to like SSH into all 2,000 computers that this thing is running on, stop them all at the same point, and presents to the user an understandable view of the state of 2,000 different executions of the same code, and how can all 2,000 of them efficiently and in a comprehensible manner single step through the code and identify any divergence, or how can all 2,000 of them watch the same variable and stop at the point where they all encounter that a change to that variable. Oh, and by the way, how can they all do it on this like sort of weird, not quite custom, but certainly made to measure, rather than off the shelf or off the rack implementation of the CPU and the GPU? Because like the GPUs that you get from NVIDIA for doing this stuff aren't the things that you just buy to play AAA games on a PC. They are tuned and dedicated and designed for this high performance workflow. The CPUs you buy aren't just fast gaming CPUs, they are things that have been tuned to this workflow. And like I said, there's only a small amount of that software around, and there's only a small amount of languages it supports. Where do you find compilers that are optimized for targeting those types of hardware? There's only a small number of those around. So rewrite your program in Python is a non-starter just because of the performance characteristics of Python. You do see a lot of scientific code and a lot of HPC code that uses Python, but it uses it to drive code that has actually been written in Fortran and just has a high-level binding in Python to sort of do the workflow management. If you said, okay, well, we want to make sure that there absolutely isn't ever a null pointer reference in any of this, like Fortran or C++ code that's been used in the community for years, so we're going to rewrite it in Rust. It can't be that hard, can it? You don't only have to rewrite the code. You have to rewrite the Rust compiler to efficiently target these systems. GCC still has way better OpenMP support than LLVM. And that kind of seems to be what the GCC folks are really focusing on in, to some extent. That is an area where it would be hard for LLVM and thus for LLVM targeted languages like Rust to catch up. You have to get the compiler working. You have to have a debugger that is going to work. You have to have a debugger that's going to plug into this. How do I visualize 2,000 instances of this debugger on a running program, architecture? And there's only so many of those. You need your mathematical libraries to target this language or to be accessible from this language and to still be correct. And then you need to port your actual model code. And then you need to convince the operations team at your supercomputer site, who have got the similar decades of experience of running the Fortran and C++ code, to start allowing these compilers and these libraries to be used on their computer, and they're going to have to manage those as well. So you have to bring this entire ecosystem with you, and it's already a niche ecosystem. Climate modeling is this tiny part. Well, yeah, it's a sizable part of HPC actually, but HPC is a tiny part of world computing. It is high profile, which is why the various vendors support it. Well, a combination of high profile and influence from various governments is why they support it. If you've got the top supercomputers in the world, then that makes people sort of notice when they decide what they want to build their own data centers out of. Of course, these days there aren't that many companies building their own data centers. The lion's share of the supercomputer market is Intel and Nvidia. So what the other players, like Arm, are trying to do is just to get some installations so that people go, oh, look, you can use Arm as a server thing. Let me look at that for my data center, or let me look at that for actually what does my cloud provider offer? Because, like I say, nobody is building data centers anymore. So it is largely a vanity project from the perspective of the vendors. There is a lot of money in it, but there is also so much R&D that goes into each iteration. We're currently trying to work out a path to what is called exascale, which is the very woolly idea of order of magnitude jump in computing, where you either have exaflops, so that many floating point operations per second, or exabytes, so that much data in your working set. And there may even be a different way that you can define exascale. But there's a lot. It costs a lot to design the system. It costs a lot to buy the system, but it's then going to sit there operating for years. These centers typically upgrade their computers on maybe it's a 3-year, maybe it's 5-year, maybe it's an 8-year scale. Whoever is top of the vanity list this year, and it really is a vanity list because it's based on some ridiculous benchmark that doesn't reflect any real world code. Whoever is top of the vanity list this year will probably be within the top 10 for a couple of years, but will slide down to like number 100 as everybody else starts, you know, refreshing their hardware. But like all of that said, it's not really a whole lot of spare money in it because it all goes into the R&D. So there's, you know, there's sort of guaranteed income because it's government funded. There is the you know, the kudos that comes from being at the top of the list and like, you know, getting all in the papers saying you know, Intel and Atos Bull are powering the fastest supercomputer in the world this year, or you know, ARM and the Japanese Supercomputer Center have just turned on the fastest supercomputer in the world. But that doesn't really sort of translate into a whole lot of benefit. So rewriting all of the model and thus breaking away from the main line of this niche of high performance computing into a sub niche of this niche is very difficult. And that is one of the reasons that these traditional languages like Fortran, like C++, have survived for so long. On the one hand, there is like the continual investment in all of the existing known working models that can be ported to new architectures. On the other hand, there is the investment in the tool support for this particular weird way of doing computing. And on the third hand, there is the investment in making that kind of software run well in that kind of weird environment that has been done, you know, by the hardware vendors and the compiler and library people. So all of this comes together to say that this is a, you know, while it is the cutting edge in many ways of computing, particularly of mathematical computing, it's really like quite a conservative and like slow changing environment where additive innovations are much more likely than rewrites. And I think that that is something that the people sort of discussing, well, why don't they just rewrite everything in Julia or in Python or in Rust, don't notice. And I think it's something that they could probably learn from as well, because if the rest of the computing world was as conservative as and additive, if we all like spent our innovation tokens wisely, then, you know, maybe we would have software that is in daily use where we have just iteratively fixed the bugs over the last three decades, rather than, you know, rewriting in every novel programming language or paradigm or framework that comes along. So, rant over. I hope you're enjoying the podcast. If you are, you know, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/IAMLEEG, IAMLEEG. If you have anything you would like to share, you know, I'd love to discuss topics like this with you. You can send me an email, grahamlee@acm.org. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you for listening. Take care, stay safe, and I will talk to you again soon.